And two guests for you. Stanton Friedman, of course. I'll introduce him in a second. He can stay with us as long as he wants. Jesse Marcel Jr. joined the U.S. Navy in 1962. He was assigned to the USS Renville and shortly thereafter participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis, attached to combat units as a member of the ship's company. The Renville then sailed for Westpac and then on to the Southeast Pacific area, where he participated in combat training in case of enemy attacks on the ship. After the Westpac tour, he completed specialty training, and here I go with this one. It's otolaryngology, I guess. That's the study of nose, ears, the throat, in any kinds of disorders and diseases. At the Naval Hospital in San Diego, California, that's where he specialized in that. Jesse retired from the Navy in 1971, entered private practice in Montana. He joined the Montana Army National Guard in 1973, went through helicopter training as a flight surgeon at Fort Rucker, Alabama, earning his wings in 81. During his career in the National Guard, he was also appointed the state surgeon of the state of Montana. Jesse is the son of the late Jesse Marcel, who was the first military officer at the 1947 crash site. And tonight he will tell his father's story and his own, the Roswell legacy. Let's introduce, first of all, Jesse Marcel Jr. Dr. Marcel, how are you?
Very good, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good. And how did I get your specialty? Was I close?
That was close enough. You know, close enough for government work.
Okay. And let me introduce, of course, the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman. You all know him. He's been on the program before. He is an expert in investigating UFO cases. His websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. He's been a physicist. He has been all over the place working for Fortune 500 companies. And he's considered also the father of Roswell. He was the first to investigate the incident in 1978. Stanton Friedman back with us. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Well, it's early in the morning, 3 o'clock here, but I'm fine.
I always do that.
I've got a new story for you, George. I just have to. This is the cheap conspiracy story.
Okay.
This came over the wires, the CIA to air decades of its dirty laundry next week, which just happens to be when Roswell stuff will be starting.
Interesting.
A Washington Post article. It's a long article, and you'll be hearing all about all the dirty laundry from the CIA, all the bad things they did back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Bound to try to drown out Roswell, I think. Right, Jess? They're taking away our airtime.
I think so. No question about that.
Well, I'm going to be live in Roswell on July 6th, and you two, I trust, will be there, right?
I'm looking forward to it.
With bells on, with bells on.
Okay, great. And you're invited to come by the program when I'm on. One of the reasons we've got Stan tonight, of course, is he has written the foreword to the book, The Roswell Legacy. But just as important, Stan was the reason why that this whole story came out. Stan, you got to tell us this incredible story about how when you were, I believe you were where, in Louisiana? At a television, yeah, you were in a TV station studio promoting one of your college speeches. That's where I met you in 1971, as a matter of fact, in Detroit. You were there, and you found out about this case. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was really crazy. I was supposed to do three interviews at the station, and the first two interviews went off quickly, and then the third reporter was nowhere to be found, and they didn't have cell phones back then. So the station manager is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the person that brought me to the station, and he knew I had other things to do. And out of the blue, out of his embarrassment, I guess, he suddenly says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And great investigator that I am, I said, who's he? And his line just knocked me over. He said, well, he handled wreckage of a crash flying saucer when he was in the military. What? You know, well, tell me more about him. Well, he lives over in Houma. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. And you know, the reporter showed up, so there was like a 20-minute window of opportunity there. The next morning, after a great crowd at LSU, I called information from the airport in Baton Rouge and got a number for Jesse and called him and talked to him. He told me his story, but he didn't have a precise date. And he was the intelligence officer at the base in Roswell. And, you know, I knew there were loads of sightings in the summer of 47. Well, a few months later, I was in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody approached me about, did you ever hear anything about a crashed saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, I have. I got information, shared it the very next day with Bill Moore, who lived in Minnesota at that time. And Bill had a third story from an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an English publication, about an English actor named Huey Green, who, when driving across the country from L.A. to Philadelphia, heard on the radio about a crashed saucer in New Mexico. His son lived in Canada. Bill was able to dig out a date from him, like early July 1947. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library Periodicals Department, started looking. There was the story, verifying what Jesse had told me and giving us the names of other people who were involved. And that began a two-year quest. We talked to 62 people. This is before the Internet, so we found people the hard way. Before the first book came out, the Roswell incident, Bill and I did over 90% of the research, and the book was written by Charles Berlitz with Bill. And over the next five years, we located another group of people, was totaling up to 92, and we published papers at the MUFON network, and I'll be giving one about Roswell at this year's MUFON conference in August. It's on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And that led to the NBC program. I instigated that, the one about Roswell.
Right.
They did Unsolved Mysteries. And would you believe there were people who called into that program who had heard about it from one person or another?
Sure.
That led to a flood. My own book in 92, a new issue in 97, A Crash at Corona. And let me clear up something. People keep asking me, you mean Corona is different from Roswell? The crash occurred 80 miles or so from Roswell. The closest town, if you can call it that, is Corona, a small place. So we called our book, Don Berliner and I, Crash at Corona. It's the Roswell incident.
It's the Roswell incident. Okay, so at what point, let's bring Jesse in for a second. And Stan, you're more than welcome to stay with us all night if you want. I mean,
well,
you're...
if I can stay awake.
It's the invite is there. Jesse, in 1947, how old were you at that time?
I was 11 years old in 47.
Okay, so this is going to make you 70, 71 years old now, right?
Yeah, I'll be 71 at the end of August, and that's that's what it'll be.
I love the book, The Roswell Legacy, but what took you so long to write it?
You know, I first started writing this book when I was in Iraq. I figured that, boy, I'm getting older, and signs of mortality are all around me, as you might imagine there. So I thought, you know, I better get this down in paper before I go, because I would really like people to realize what the story meant to me and to my family. So that's when I started writing it. And it just basically, it's the effect of what Roswell has on my family and hopefully the civilization of the world. But again, it was just because I realized that time is getting short, so I better get this thing down before it's too late.
How old
you better
was...
tell people what Jesse was doing in Iraq, Jess.
Sir? What's that?
He wanted to know what were you doing in Iraq?
I was a flight surgeon with an attack helicopter battalion, so I got a lot of flight hours in Black Hawk. As a matter of fact, I saw most of Iraq from the cockpit of a Black Hawk, which was very interesting. Probably the safest place to be at that time.
And I assume that's through the first Gulf War, obviously.
No, that's just the one that's going on right now.
Really?
Yes.
What were you when they called you in, Jeff?
You know, I got called. You know, I retired from the Guard in '96, and lo and behold, when the Gulf War broke out again, they called me back into the regular Army this time as a flight surgeon, and so I went over to Iraq in, I guess, October of 2004. And finally got home in November of 2005, so I spent 13 months out there.
Jesse, you were 67, 68 years old right around then, right?
Right then, yeah. You know, I thought I was going to be the oldest guy out there, but no, there was another one 73-year-old out there.
I can't believe that.
I thought I was going to be the top honors in there, but now they had some guys older than I out there. So
I mean, you said when you said that you were in Iraq, I'm saying, okay, maybe he was in 91. No, I never would have anticipated this.
No, I just got home, as a matter of fact. So, as a matter of fact, my unit may be going back next year, and it's possible I might go back with them. I don't know.
Absolutely incredible. Well, good for you, and thank you for what you've done.
Well, it was a very interesting tour, and I'd go back in a heartbeat.
How old was Dad when he passed on?
Let's see, he was born in 1907, and he died in 86. So, I guess 79.
So he's about 79 years old.
Yes.
Okay.
Huh?
All right. When you were this little 11-year-old boy, we're going to talk with you tonight in two fronts, Jesse. One's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old.
Uh-huh.
And then it's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the adult who's taken this Roswell legacy through these years. And, Stanton, I'd want you to jump in any time because you're going to be the color commentator tonight in this program,
okay.
Right?
But well, I'm one of the few investigators that's been in the home of both Jesse Sr. and Jesse Jr.
Well, what's going to make this program so, I think, phenomenal is you, Stanton Friedman, have the nuances down about every little issue in Roswell, so nothing will be unturned tonight. And I'm glad you're with us. This is historical as far as I'm concerned. Historical for two reasons for me, Jesse. Number one, when I was a 21-year-old radio reporter in Detroit, Stan was my very first radio interview. They sent me to a college, and there he was, and I was fascinated with UFOs before I went in, and I was never the same when I came out. And in your particular case, knowing what your father did, it has been my lifelong ambition to interview you over all these years that I've been doing radio talk, which is now well over 10 years. I've wanted to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate your kind words.
You know, Stan would be on my programs 10 years ago, for example, and always talk about your father's case, and then he would start talking about you. So I'm glad you're here with both of us. But let's talk now about Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old. On the day of the crash, do you remember what your father said? I mean, did he start sharing some of this information right away, or did that take time?
Well, that took a little time. But actually, no, what his job was to go out to the rancher, for the Foster Ranch, and pick up some of the representative parts of the debris. And as it turns out, our house was on the way back to the airbase. But this is about maybe midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning when he came back through town. And what he had done, he realized it's very special, that something we would never see again, which is right. He wanted to show it to my mother and myself. So he had pre-positioned a lot of this debris on the kitchen floor. Then he got my mother and myself up to look at this. So we got in there and looked at this. There's this metallic debris. He said, look at this. I think he used the word flying saucer. Not quite sure. But he wants us to examine the debris for what it looked like. And, first of all, he said, look for any vacuum tubes or any electronic components. Of course, he already knew there wasn't, but he wanted us to be satisfied about that. So we looked around there, again, no condensers, resistors, vacuum tubes, or wires of any kind. And he said, well, look at this. Look at the foil and look at the little beams here. So I picked up the foil. I didn't try to bend it or tear it or stress it like other people did. I just, this is kind of strange-looking stuff, But I think the strange part were the beams. It had looked like symbols written along the inner surface of the column there. And I remember at first thinking that was like Egyptian hieroglyphics, but no, it's not Egyptian hieroglyphics. And it's more like geometric symbols of some kind. But these were imprinted along the inner surface. And I do remember the distinct color. They were like a purple-violet hue, kind of reflective of the light there is in the overhead in the kitchen there.
Did your father, Jesse, ever say at that time, this is a balloon, this is a military U.S. craft, this is something Earth-made,
man-made? Heavens no. This is something very unique. If it was that, he would not have taken the time to bring it by the house. So
he told me in our first conversation that what was strange to him is that when he went out to the crash site, he couldn't find anything conventional. He'd been at plane crashes before. He was in a plane that got shot down. I think Jesse Jr. shares that distinction. And there wasn't anything that you'd expect from a military aircraft crash. Nothing conventional. That's important.
And what's important tonight, too, and I want everybody to understand this, we have all kinds of guests on this program. Some are entertaining. Some are very darn right scientific. We're talking with a medical-trained doctor who has no reason to make up this story on things that he saw and heard from his father, who was the first military officer on the crash. And Stanton, I think that's so important. I think Jesse may be one of the most credible witnesses we've ever had.
Oh, of course. No question about that.
Well, thank you.
So,
yeah, we need more like Jesse to come forward, and I'm sure there is still some out there, incidentally.
Yes, that's true. I guess, Jesse, your father never said that there were crash dummies at the site, right?
No, decidedly not. No dummies there. But, yeah, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is to maybe help trigger some people to come out and start talking about this. You know, the guys, the first-handers who are still alive, you know, come on out, you know, test the waters. It's fine. Tell what you know. Let people know what happened out there.
Stan, when you were talking to Jesse Marcel, Sr., did he ever tell you what he thought this was?
Yeah, it was something not of this world. One of the early interviews with him that's on tape is in my movie, UFOs Are Real. We went to HOMA and filmed him in like 1978, late 78. And he explicitly stated that it was something not from this world. We didn't know what it was, but it wasn't from here. And he was, you know, he was an intelligence officer for the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. It was his job to know what was going on. He knew about the rockets over at White Sands. He had been at plane crashes. There was nothing normal, conventional, anything like that about what he saw. So he didn't say it's from Zeta Reticuli. I mean, I say that now in my new book. But
hey, this...
he certainly indicated it wasn't from Earth.
Stan, I want to get your reaction and Jesse's reaction also when we come back after the break. Earlier this week, we had Bill Burns on, the publisher of UFO Magazine. You both know him. And Bill was telling us about the Walter Haut affidavit, apparently, that he signed, testifying exactly what Jesse Marcel Sr. has said, backed up now by another military officer who was there. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling.
It's in a new book, Witness to Roswell.
All right, well, everyone, stay with us. This is, for me, a historical night on Coast to Coast. We'll be back with Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman. We talk about the Roswell legacy. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Jesse, when your father brought some of the debris home for your family to look at, had that picture with General Ramey already been taken, that picture with your father that we've all have seen by now, or did that come afterwards?
That came afterwards because... Again, what he was doing, he was on his way to the airbase when he went by the house and showed the debris to my mother and myself. And after we brought the material to the airbase for the base commanders, Blanchard, to look at this, they decided this was something very unusual. So Colonel Blanchard dispatched my dad to Fort Worth, where General Ramey is located, to show Ramey the debris. And that's where the photographs were taken. In Ramey's office. So this is afterwards.
Okay, when you looked at what was put in the paper, did those items look the same to you, or did they look like they might have been switched?
Well, you know, I didn't see the pictures immediately. Actually, it's several years later that I learned of the photographs that were taken in General Ramey's office. But I can tell you right now, that was not what was on our kitchen floor. And if you look at my dad's face, you know, when he's holding up a piece of this radar target, he's like, you got to be kidding me. You know, what is this all about? But they're trying to demonstrate that that was just a weather balloon. There is even a balloon envelope in the background there. So this is just parts of a radar target, a Rowan radar target.
Jesse, did he come home later on and say, doggone it, they're changing the story, or they've told me to say this? Anything like that?
Okay, what he did, when he came back home, and I'm not sure whether it was the next day or what the time of this is, but when he came back, yeah, he sat my mother and myself down and says, look, don't ever talk about this. This is something that didn't happen. just treat it as a non-event. And by golly, that's the way we treated it for many, many years afterwards. But so he told me not to ever talk about this. And I think I remember seeing him in an interview one time where he said he was actually became part of the cover-up himself. But I'm not sure if that's whether that's accurate or not. But anyway, he just told us don't talk about it.
Stanton, yeah. do you believe he was frustrated as the years went by?
Well, I think he was, but I think you have to understand something here. Jesse was in the military. He fought in World War II, Jesse Sr. You follow orders, and that was standard practice.
Yes.
It would have been quite extraordinary if he hadn't followed orders. And all through this story, we have chain of command. Jesse Sr. was a major. He reported to Colonel Blanchard. Colonel Blanchard reported to General Ramey in Fort Worth, who was head of the 8th Air Force. He reported to General McMullen, who was temporary head of Strategic Air Command in Washington. Colonel DuBose, who worked for General Ramey, took the call from General McMullen telling him three things. And I got this directly from DuBose. Blanchard was dead, and McMullen was dead, and Ramey was dead. But DuBose was alive. I located him. And he was told, send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers. I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. And I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. He doesn't argue about it. Colonel Marcel, who's on the program now, can tell you that, right, Jeff?
You betcha. You better believe it.
Jesse, as you were growing up in Roswell, did the story of the crash kind of filter around the people who lived there?
Well, you know, after this happened, you know, there were a plethora of reports of strange things flying through the sky at that time. But, you know, it was summertime. I was having fun with my friends riding bicycles. And my dad told me not to talk about that, so I kind of put it in the back of my mind. Never forgetting about it, but I put it out of mind at that time.
So people were seeing UFOs or something in the skies way before the crashes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of newspaper accounts of strange things being seen in the sky, you know, and I guarantee they were not weather balloons.
Stanton, what would be in that area that would be of interest to extraterrestrials?
Well, I think you have to understand that New Mexico was a hotbed of advanced classified research and development. There are two nuclear weapons labs in New Mexico. The base there, Roswell, the home of the 509th, the only atomic bombing group in the world. The largest military base in the country was White Sands Missile Range, to the west of there, about 100-some miles. Kirtland Air Force Base was the largest single employer in the state of New Mexico. That's up in Albuquerque. There was the group, the 509th in Roswell, Cannon Air Force Base. If there was one state that you could be sure spies would be present, it would be New Mexico. That's why when Jesse went out, he was told to take a counterintelligence corps guy with him. And you knew Cabot, didn't you, Jesse?
Oh, yes. They're close friends with the family. Sheridan Cabot.
Yeah, he was counterintelligence, and he had a different chain of command than Jesse Marcel Sr. did. But there's no question that, remember, the first atomic bomb test was over at White Sands Missile Range in 1945, July 16th. Incidentally, the press was told an ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately nobody was injured. They had plenty of experience at covering things up. So, you know, it's not surprising that visitors would be there. And, you know, consider the times. There were a lot of sightings. The first sighting that got a lot of attention, Kenneth Arnold's sighting, was up in Washington State. And Hanford Works are in Washington State, mm-hmm. where they were making plutonium. And
same year, wasn't it? Arnold was 47 also, wasn't he?
Just 2 weeks earlier, June 24th. Yep. It hit the paper on June 25th. And this was less than 2 weeks after that, and there were 2,000 sightings in that period of time. July 4th weekend, hotbed of sightings all over the country. I mean, there was a little ridicule around. One of the states where there weren't any sightings. 44 had sightings. One where there wasn't was Kansas, which, of course, was dry. That was one of the newspaper articles.
Can we assume that the objects that Kenneth Arnold saw, Stanton, that these might have been the objects involved in the crashes?
Well, we don't know. There were nine objects. He timed their passage from in front of one mountain to in front of another, knew the distance in between. It comes out between 1,200 and 1,500 miles an hour. The speed record at the time was like 675. First supersonic flight wasn't until October that year. Arnold's thought was, hey, the atom bomb was developed in secret. These are new government military craft. Didn't make it into World War II, but they're probably ours. They certainly were different from anything he ever knew anything about, and he was an experienced pilot.
I'm at the belief now, Stanton, that there's always a mothership and that these craft come down and they do their maneuvers within our atmosphere, but they're not the ones that come here.
Well, I agree with that entirely, yeah. And I've used the analogy that we have aircraft carriers, huge monsters that don't need to be refueled for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the Navy. He knows about them. And little small airplanes. Now, it would make sense because we have reports of huge objects in the sky, say half mile to a mile long. They're not the ones that crash or come down and land or whatever. They're way out there. But there's some excellent reports up in the Yukon, the Japan Airlines case of 20 years ago. A half a mile long? That's huge.
That's big.
But remember, the two different environments between the stars, where there's a lot of nothing. And then when you get near a planet, you got a lot of gravity, you got an atmosphere, you got to worry about heating and all kinds of things. And going the speed of light doesn't make a lot of sense around the planet. It only takes a seventh of a second to go around.
Jesse,
somebody for lunch at that velocity.
Did your father, from the moment he told you and your mother, we're not talking about this anymore? And we'll get to the deathbed discussions you had
okay. The
days before he died. But in between that, did he say anything about it over the years?
Well, you know, I guess the closest thing was standing at the supermarket checkout line. You know, you have these magazines that sensationalize UFO, or at least I was kidnapped to, was brought to Venus, and this, that, and the other. And we kind of would look at each other and say, well, yeah, we know better than that, but that's basically all we talked about at that time.
I should throw in here that the man at the television station, I talked to him years later and asked what Jesse had told him about the case. And he said, look, we were ham buddies. And I asked him about it, and he said, I can't talk about that. And I mention that because I have people saying, oh, Jesse was talking all over the place, making up stories. That's malarkey. Jesse didn't tell this guy anything, but he remembered him, and those guys, ham radio buddies, have a good connection, right, Jess?
They're real buddies there.
Jesse, what about people like Walter Hout? Did you know him? He stayed in Roswell. If you did know him, what were your impressions of him?
Well, you know, Walter and his wife lived right down the block from us there at 1300 West 7th Street in Roswell. And I don't know if they're that close, you know, with my folks, but I'm sure I've met Walter on many occasions back at that time. Because they just, like I say, they live right just a few doors down from us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we asked Walter about Jesse Jr. way back, Bill Moore and I, years and years back in the 70s. And it was interesting that what he said, he was a bright young lad. That's what Walter said about
that. Well, nice.
He was right.
Yeah, sure he was.
Oh, he is a bright.
Of course. But,
you know, and incidentally, Walter dropped the instrument package in one of the two nuclear weapons that were tested at Operation Crossroads in 1946 in the Pacific. And I mention that because one skeptic says, oh, he just made up the story. In the first place, the public information officer for the 509th would never make up a story without the boss's permission, kind of thing. In the second place, he obviously had to be one of the best bombardiers around, or he wouldn't have been chosen for that job, because the test doesn't make any sense if you can't get instrument measurements.
Good point.
There's
now,
an awful lot of malignment of the people involved here by the nasty, noisy negativists.
Stanton, when did the debris go to Wright? Patterson?
Well, Jesse,
immediately?
Jesse didn't take it to Wright-Patt. He stopped in Fort Worth, Texas.
Right, right.
We know that because of an FBI memo, that it was apparently the same day, July 8th, that a separate flight was sent up to Wright Field. Now, there's a standard technique in intelligence work, and Jesse Jr. can talk about that, where you break the chain so the guys at the beginning don't know where it winds up at the end. So Jesse Sr. didn't see the guys who got it up at Wright Field, and they didn't see the guys who brought it from Fort Worth, from Roswell to Fort Worth.
It's compartmentalization of information.
Yeah, standard practice.
What about the occupants, Jesse? Did your dad ever talk about the aliens?
You know,
we've heard so much about.
He never did discuss it with me. Although I guess he might very well. He was in a position to have seen them, but again, he never really discussed this finding with me.
Stanton, do we know if Jesse Marcel even saw the aliens?
He certainly never talked to me about it. It was interesting, though, that a man named Louis Rickett, and Jess, I think you knew him, too.
Yes, huh? Sure did.
He was another counterintelligence corps guy. He, in a conversation I had with him, said that there were certain things that weren't talked about, except under very special, you know, closed doors, cleared facilities, all that kind of thing. He was hinting at something like that, but he didn't flat out say anything about bodies, but it would seem they would have fallen in that class of information not to be discussed outside. But Jesse Sr. never, in that first television interview and stuff, never talked about bodies as far as I know.
Where did we get the information of the occupants? How did that come about?
From the crash over at the Plains of San Augustine and Glenn Dennis's testimony. He was
okay.
The mortician in town who told about the nurse who told him that she got grabbed to help out with a dissection or an autopsy, I'm not sure which, at the base hospital. And we haven't been able to find that nurse, and Glenn is still alive but not in good health, and I'm sure he won't be doing any interviews during the Roswell fiesta coming
right
up, where Jesse and I will be probably doing lots of interviews. And, you know, I still haven't heard where you can get Jesse's book, because I know it's not at my bookstore here, and I'm anxious to see it. Jesse, you got copies available
for the
public?
Yeah, if people are interested, it's on marceljr.com. There's a display about the book there, or the roswelllegacy.com. Those are the two websites that they can look at for information on the book. But I guess the best one would be marceljr.com.
Okay, we've got to get this out on Amazon, Jesse, because people will be searching for this like crazy.
That's right. Well, I think it'll be very interesting. Like I say, it's a book that explains the feelings of the family toward the Roswell event and what it's done for us.
Jesse, what did this do to your father? Did you see any kind of personality change? I mean, if you really know, firsthand that we've been visited by extraterrestrials from another land, I mean, that would have a profound effect on us. Did you see a change?
Well, you know, I really wasn't around at that time because I was in the Navy and I was off at school and things like that, so I really didn't have any close personal contact with my dad during those years after that. But I do know one thing, that he must have been frustrated about something, because when we moved up here to Helena, we brought the cedar chest that had all his medals and decorations in it. When I went through that, they're all gone. So I think he must have gotten so frustrated he threw them away.
That's something.
That's too bad. But we could get them back, of course, as records, but the original medals are no longer present.
Did you, at what point did you begin to tell yourself, now, because we're going to get into your story, that something was very unusual, something happened here that was out of this world?
Well, you know, not until after 1978, that's when my dad was starting to talk about it. And then people would come over to ask me about that, because, of course, the namesake there. So I really didn't talk very much about it before then. But since my dad died in 86, that's when I've been catching a lot of flack also, and people have really been coming to me and say, well, what really happened? What's your opinion? What do you think was this, that, and the other?
And we should mention here that, Jess, you were involved in military aircraft accident investigations, too, weren't you?
Yeah. You know, as a flight surgeon, you do have a course in the aircraft accident investigation. And, you know, I've seen a number of, you know, aircraft accidents at various places here. So anyway, it's not unusual for me to, you know, at least I've seen aircraft accidents. I do know that the material seen in Roswell was not from that, though.
Stan, did
that's
they...
my point. You were in a position to make a judgment about that, having been at accident.
You bet.
Did they find any craft intact at all, Stan, or were they all just simply obliterated?
Well, the one over in the plains of San Augustine apparently had a big crack in the side, and it was almost intact, would be a way to put it. The bodies were outside, and the government covered that one up, too, and it wouldn't surprise me if there was a mid-air collision between the two. And I had one person say, hey, if one UFO is rare, how could you have two in the same place? And I should
right.
say that 40% of the 853 sightings reported in the UFO wave of 1947, a sort of book by a guy named Ted Blocher, 40% of the cases involved more than one object seen at a time. And it's standard practice, and Jess can verify this, to send up a pilot and a wingman on missions. So if they ran into a radar beam, if they ran into a storm, whatever, in a mid-air collision, I asked a retired general who'd been a pilot and who had been base commander at Roswell in the mid-60s, General Exxon, I said, if you have a aircraft collision in the air, is the damage usually symmetric, that is the same in the two aircraft? He said, no. Usually one will make it down barely and the other one tough luck. And that's what seems to have happened here. What Jesse saw, Jesse Sr., was debris spread out over this huge area. And one of the things he told me in our first conversation is there was no crater, which means there had to be a mid-air explosion.
Yes, it blew up.
Spread stuff over three-quarters of a mile
exactly.
long and hundreds of yards wide.
What are the right. possibilities that these were two different types of ETs and maybe they shot at each other?
Wow, now you're getting into science fiction. I have no idea.
You know, I would like to add that. You know, one thing, you know, the debris that I saw looked like it came from the interior of something. You know, because there was not any really structural material there. So this looked like it came from the inside, like it was blown through the side of the craft.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
An interior bulkhead or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have asked me, well, if this stuff is so strong and indestructible, you know, how come it was...
Save that, Stan. Save that when we come right back. We'll be back in a moment. Jesse Marcel, Jr., Stanton Friedman on Coast to Coast AM. Stanton, you and Jesse, you were talking about the material that... that Jesse Marcel was looking at. I'd let you, Stan, pick it up from there.
Well, he described it to me as being stuff he had never seen before, and he was familiar with rockets and all these other things. And I hear people saying that, you know, this is all made up, it's a fictional account. Be wary of the noisy negativists is all I can say. Jesse was familiar with airplanes. And, you know, rivets and wires and the other things you find on airplanes and little tags that say made in Oshkosh and stuff like that. The same goes for Jesse Jr. now. He's flown airplanes. And so the material was quite extraordinary. It wasn't just standard stuff that we have today. The memory metal, Jesse in our first conversation told how one of his people took a hunk of metal that was there and put one end on a rock and the other end on the ground and hit it with a sledgehammer and didn't make a dent in it. And it was extraordinarily lightweight. It would have been nice if we had that kind of stuff. We still don't have it for building airplanes out.
No, not at all. When your father brought the material home, Jesse,
yes.
How did he do it? Was it in a box, a crate, or did he just bring it in?
It's in cardboard boxes, and this was in the back seat of our 1942 Buick, and they had brought it in the house and just spread the stuff out on the floor. As a matter of fact, the box wasn't entirely empty. There's still some debris inside of it, but I think he just took the representative portions out and spread out there so we could take a look at it and see what this was. But Stan's right. This did not come from any kind of known aircraft that I've ever seen, and I'm sure my dad either.
We need to stress here that one of the reasons that Jesse and Cabot, Sheridan Cabot, went out there is because the rancher let them know that there was loads of stuff out there. He only brought in a little to town in his pickup truck, his small pickup truck. And I mention this because some of the terrible documentaries of the last several months make it look like there was just a little pile of stuff in area 20 feet square. Even the cover-up article on July 9th said it covered an area 200 yards in diameter. And that ain't no mogul balloon, man.
No, not at all. And was the farmer, Brazel, was he cooperative?
Well, he was. The kicker was here. He'd found this stuff. The ranch was out in the middle of nowhere. There's no road there. And he had shown the neighbors, and he went into town on Saturday the 5th, into the town of Corona to do his standard shopping. Now, remember, he didn't have a telephone. He didn't have electricity. He didn't get a newspaper. He hadn't heard about flying saucers. But when he was at the Wade's General Store in Corona, that's when he heard about those things. And also there have been articles that those people had seen about there was a reward for flying saucers. And they suggested he go into the sheriff in Roswell, see if he could collect the reward. I've got the article. It was a couple thousand bucks, which is a lot of money back then. And so he was cooperative. He went to the sheriff's office. The sheriff called the base, talked to Jesse. Jesse came out and looked at this weird stuff. And the reason Colonel Blanchard told Jesse to go out there, they had to follow the rancher out there, he and Cabot in their separate vehicles, because in a way, they didn't have GPS back then. There's no way to say, here are the coordinates to see what you can see. They had to follow him out there, much of it cross-country, to get to the stuff. So he was cooperative. He gave them a can of beans, Jesse told me that in our first conversation. They stayed overnight in their sleeping bag. He took them to the debris field the next day. And Jesse's pondering this whole scene. They came back, and would you know that the government went out and grabbed the rancher and brought him back while Jesse was off to Fort Worth, Texas? They kept the rancher and fed him a new story about dates and what the stuff was like. And the Air Force mentions part of that story in their two terrible reports, but they don't give the straight scoop about anything. It was a sad tale of government cover-up.
Do we know, Jesse, how many trucks showed up to take the debris away? Did your dad ever mention that?
No, he didn't mention how much there was there. Although it did, like Stan was saying, cover a considerable area, and certainly was a lot more than the small representative part of the debris that he brought home. So there's a lot of it.
Is it possible he did see the aliens, but was so shocked, maybe so overcome, he didn't want to tell anybody, at least any of the family members?
Well, that's certainly possible. I know he was pretty close-mouthed about this because he was very definite about not talking about it anymore. And it's certainly possible he could have seen something like that. But, again, he didn't mention it to me nor Stan, so, I just don't know.
Remember, he was a dutiful military officer who was in intelligence work. Keeping your lips closed was an important part of that job.
Yes.
I'm very interested, Jesse, in the beam that you looked at when you were a child. Did it look like it was broken off, or did it look intact?
Well, I'm just trying to think about that. It was about 12 to 18 inches long, and it had like an I-beam configuration. And there was, I guess about 3/8 of an inch in cross-sectional diameter. I don't recall whether the ends were fractured or whether they were clean cut. I really just don't remember that.
Did it look like a handle? If you had to try to put it into some kind of other object, what might it fit into?
Well, no, who knows where it came from, but it was a metallic beam and 12 to 18 inches long with the symbols written along the inner surface of the beam there. So who knows what it was for? Yeah,
it could have held equipment
now,
in place.
Right, Jeff?
I'm sorry?
It was straight.
Yes. Oh, yes, it was straight. It was not bent or damaged.
And just with the inscriptions, didn't have screw holes in it or anything like that?
No, no. They were solid figures, and I do recall one distinctly because I could attach it to a familiar object. There was a ball over a truncated pyramid, and I remember that because it looked like a seal balancing a ball on its nose.
Now, that's incredible. A ball.
In the book, right, Ted?
Yep.
Yes, yes. It is in the book.
A ball over a truncated pyramid.
Yes.
And, I don't know. Maybe we're going to find out who built the pyramid, Stan, once and for all.
Why not?
It could have said something like, do not flush in zero gravity, for all I knew, but who knows.
How long did you stay in Roswell, Jesse? Forever, right?
Well, we moved back to Washington, D.C. My dad was stationed in Washington, not at the Pentagon, but at an office in town there in 1948 or 49, somewhere in that time frame.
Did you ever go back?
No, not in the time frame.
All right. It was Walter Haupt, Stan, who went back and lived there, right?
Well, he never left.
He never left, okay.
No, he got out of the service. His wife had a baby that year. They loved it in Roswell. He was from Chicago. Maybe you can understand that.
Sure.
I shouldn't say that. But Walter was a pillar of the community, and I want to stress that because, again, the attacks have been made, personal attacks on everybody involved in this case by the noisy negativists. Rule number three for debunkers is if you can't attack the data, attack the people. And that's been going on. And Jess Jr. wore a flak jacket in Iraq. He's going to need that as he talks about the book. Slings and arrows about rage debunkers, you know.
I tell you, it's a very interesting story.
When your father died in 1986, was there a deathbed confession? Was there anything more that he told you, Jesse?
I called him dutifully every Saturday, and shortly before he died, he had gone out back to Roswell at the behest of one of the TV stations in New Orleans to do a program, and they filmed him out there walking across the field. And I asked him on the when I called him, I said, "Well, was there jokingly, of course, was there any of it left?" And his words were, "No, they vacuumed the place up." Those were his exact words: "Vacuumed the place up."
Vacuumed the place up.
That's a comment I heard, too.
And, matter of fact, I have it on a tape. You know, somebody, he recorded the conversation, and I found that tape, and it's somewhere in the files here, but I have that conversation.
Did he ever put anything down in writing?
I don't think so. He does have a diary, but I looked through that, and it didn't really disclose anything that I didn't already know.
But did he talk about the crash, though?
Yeah, not in the diary, no.
Not in the
again,
diary.
That was a taboo subject. We were not to discuss it or even write about it, I guess.
Yeah, he was given orders, Stan. Something really happened there.
Well, no question about that. And, again, you have to look at the military in 1947. We just won a huge war. Here's the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. Part of Jess Sr.'s job was to brief pilots when they went out on simulated missions in the B-29s that were there. Not many people were involved with nuclear weapons. And maybe it's ironic, maybe it's appropriate, that the same outfit that dropped the bombs on Japan winds up with the wreckage of an alien spacecraft that might be running around because of those bombs.
That's possible, sure.
Jesse, let's get your take on what you now, after all these years in your head, what do you now believe happened out there?
Well, I believe as advertised. I think it was a wreck or a crash of an extraterrestrial craft. I can't tie it in with anything familiar, and the material is such an unusual character that again, I've never seen anything like it before, but I realize that the immense possibilities of life elsewhere are just all over. You know, like the Hubble telescope is getting pictures of other planetary systems. We're actually looking at multiple planetary systems. And some of these may very well be Earth-like and with their civilization. So I recognize the possibility of extraterrestrial flight because they're obviously smarter than we are because they get here from wherever they come from.
Stan, this visitation, if that's what happened during this time period. The atomic age, we were really kicking up. We had already dropped the bomb 2 years earlier, two of them. Might have been probably there. They probably have some kind of sensors out there, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I think my basic rule is that any civilization is concerned about its own survival and security, which means keeping tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you. Now, if you look at technological output from our society, once we started having blast furnaces and all kinds of other things that are putting out in data, you could call it pollution, and then radio and all that stuff, suddenly it was clear this society was moving rapidly. And then you got World War II, where you've got not only nuclear weapons toward the end of it, but before that you've got the rockets, V1s, V2s. Interestingly enough, they were being tested in New Mexico in 1947 over at White Sands. So there's two of the three signs that these idiot earthlings were getting ready to leave. The third, incidentally, was advanced electronics, radar. And White Sands had some of the best radar around to track the rockets, which often didn't go where they were supposed to go. Some even wound up down in Mexico, to the consternation of the Mexicans, incidentally. So, you know, it's not surprising that they would be here on this planet at this time as we started to move forward to where we could move out there. Look, I worked on fusion propulsion systems. 10 million times as much energy per particle kicked out the back end as in a chemical rocket. That was 40-some years ago. So on a small time on a galactic scale, say 100 years from then, they would expect that Earthlings would be moving out. If you were an alien, would you want us out there? I don't think so.
Not the capacity.
Yeah, they have more to fear from us than we from them. And just look around. Look at all our wars, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East. You know, just all we do is fight. You know, so no wonder they're scared of us.
I mean, I'd rather have a guy trained in weaponry holding a pistol than a 10-year-old kid, for example.
Right.
And, you know, in the, you look at that and go, oh, my God, he could shoot someone. He could shoot himself. And maybe that's the same analogy with this, Stan.
Well, yeah, that doesn't bother me. A primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. That's how I've described us. So I'm not saying these are good guys who are here to help us or anything like that. They're obviously not here to immediately destroy us because we're still here. But, you know, we killed 50 million of our own kind during World War II.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't forget that number. We destroyed 1,700 cities. If it happened once, it could happen again. Except now the scope of our being able to kill is so much greater, wholesale instead of retail. Scares the heck out of me as a nuclear guy, frankly.
Well, and it should. Jesse, this story that you've carried for many years, since you were 11 years old, yeah, did you tuck it aside for a while and just forget about it, or did it always seem to be there?
Well, you know, of course, it's always been there. And what this has done, this has really engendered an interest in myself for astronomy and cosmology. Because since 47, I've realized that hey, we're not the only kid on the block. There's others out there also, and what's more, they're smart enough to get here from wherever they come from. And so I've been keenly interested in our universe, though, because I know it's populated.
What have you told your family, your friends over the years? Did you tell them this story of the Roswell legacy?
Well, you know, eventually the word does come out because everybody knows that, well, I have a name associated with Roswell. So sure, the family says, well, what do you know about Roswell? What did you do there? So I, you know, gradually just came out and started talking about it with them. And then they obviously became very interested in UFOs and things like that because they know that we're not the only ones.
Overdue to do the book, and now it's done.
Yes, finally.
Linda's your wife, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
What does she think of all this?
Well, she's very interested in this. You know, she's open-minded and realizes that the possibility of extraterrestrial life and visitations, and more than that, she believes me.
I'm going to read part of what Stan has written in the book, The Roswell Legacy, on the back cover. It says, the story needs to be told by someone of such high integrity as Dr. Marcel, someone who was so close to the long-ago events and people involved in them and makes the people come alive. The world has waited a long time for the inside scoop on Roswell. Truth is an excellent curative for false proclamations. The Roswell crashed saucer retrieval is one of the most important UFO cases ever. anywhere. We need more information from these directly involved, and this book provides a good deal of important new material. So true, Stanton. So true.
Yes, indeed, and I recommend people read the book and get a sense of the people involved. Like I say, the noisy negativists, and they'll be out in force over the next few weeks as we celebrate the 60th anniversary of Roswell. That's a great opportunity for the noisy negativists to get airtime and, time in the newspapers and all this kind of thing. So hopefully the book will be an antidote to the false proclamations from those guys.
Oh, you really think so?
Well, it's not that I'm trying to convince those guys, because their first rule is don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Exactly.
And the second rule is what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. But I want the public to be aware of the reality. I want them to read the book. You're not going to sell many copies of the books to a noisy negativist. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up is their attitude. But I have found, with only 11 hecklers and over 700 lectures, that there's an awful lot of good people out there willing to listen and make their own minds up.
I would love to see you. Stan, I'd love to see you handle a heckler. I bet you do it with grace.
Well, yeah, take no open-minded skeptics.
My approach.
Yeah, I don't mind open-minded skeptics, but like Stan says, the ones who don't confuse me with facts because my mind is made up types. They're out there, and they're not. You're never going to convince those guys because they're not interested in finding out the truth.
That's right.
Open-minded people are.
Jesse, did you ever put yourself in your father's position just to figure what was going through his head all these years?
You know, I have not, but that is a very interesting hypothesis there. But I kind of think that I would have done exactly what he did. He was told from the get-go, don't talk about it, don't tell your family not to talk about it, and let the story just drop right there.
Hey, Stan, when we come back, let's talk a little bit about Area 51, because I want to get your take on that and to see if you think that this material is over there now after it was taken to a right field a long, long time ago. We'll be back in a moment with Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you. You can ask them a question or two. Stan is more than welcome to stay as long as he wants. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jesse, did you ever know Frankie Rowe, who claims that her father was one of the firefighters dispatched to the crash scene?
Yeah, I've seen her at some of the meetings and met with her. She's a very nice lady.
Okay. How about you, Stan? Did you ever investigate that?
Well, the investigations I did cast serious doubt on part of her story. One, the fire department almost never went outside of town because it gets very dry in the hot summer in Roswell, as it will be next week when Jesse and I are there in 10 days, and it would leave the town defenseless. Secondly, I have problems. I mean, I've heard her story, but I have problems with the notion that a state police officer would give her a piece of wreckage to play with. The state police in New Mexico were very aware of lots of classified activities, and if they knew something about a crash, they weren't about to go spreading that around. So I think it's one of those stories that perhaps grew past its reality. Her father might have heard about it and stuff like that. But so I put that one at best in my gray basket.
See, with Roswell, you had a lot of people who came forward later with interesting stories, but not all of them were accurate, truthful.
Particularly, I think of Frank Kaufman, who I'm sure is laughing in his grave. Frank told these tales of being directly involved in recovery and seeing bodies and so forth, and then finally it turned out, and even his staunchest followers agreed, that he had made it all up. He was in Roswell at the time, no question about that. He'd been at the base during the war. He was a civilian at the time, but he was an artist, incidentally, a good one. I was at his home, and he had some drawings of what the craft and the aliens looked like, and the craft certainly came right out of the cover of Popular Mechanics issue about the TR-3A.
Stan, I interviewed him 11 years ago over the phone, and God, it was a great story. I mean,
he was a great guy to talk to. What can I say? You know, have fun. There's a little inside story here in that the guys who founded the museum, one of them was Max Littell in Roswell. Jesse and I will be there for the celebration at the International UFO Museum and Research Center. And Max was one of the people who helped develop the shopping malls, which are north of Roswell. And Frank was head of the Chamber of Commerce, and as in many, many cities, I see it here in Fredericton, the downtown people didn't want any malls because it would take the business from downtown, of course.
Exactly.
And so there was a little rivalry there, and I think Frank took advantage of the opportunity to, you know, get some of the limelight. And he was a fun guy, but he, when I asked him specifically at his home with three other witnesses present, he had originally said that Colonel Blanchard went out to the site and that Jesse Marcel Sr. went out to the site. And so I asked him in front of these other people, this wasn't too long before he died, did Blanchard go out with you? The answer was no. Did Jesse Marcel go out with you? No. You see, his story didn't make any sense. Blanchard wouldn't have gone out without knowing what was out there. I mean, he was a commander of a base that had atomic bombs and stuff.
Yeah. He'd send somebody. Yeah.
He had a big, big, big responsibility there at the base. Incidentally, he went on to be a four-star general and vice chief of staff of the Air Force, Blanchard. He wasn't punished for how he mishandled the Roswell incident at all. And so Frank admitted with other witnesses present that they hadn't gone out there. So he was a good guy, had meals with them, but there were plenty of other people that have come forward. Although in the last week I've had three emails from people who knew somebody who knew something about Roswell that I'm trying to follow up on. And, you know, I don't know whether people come out of the woods just because it's 60th anniversary time or whatever, but anybody listening who knows something, go to my website and get in touch with me, www.stantonfriedman.com. And, of course, they should go to Jesse's website and get his book. Give me the website, Jess. I can't find it.
Stan, you're good. You've learned it.
MarcelJr.com is the one that they need to go to.
What was that again?
MarcelJr.com.
Junior.com.
And Ian, you know, Stan, we link them all up for you at Coast to Coast. We make it simple for people to go to your websites. They get right there. Do you believe, I'll start with you first, Stan, and then you, Jesse, that some of this material today might be over at Area 51?
Well, I certainly believe that they wouldn't destroy the material. It would not be easy to destroy, but there's an important factor here, and I started working industry 50 years ago, and one of the things that's changed greatly has been that our analytical techniques have increased at an incredible rate. You know, instead of tenths of a percent of something, you can measure parts per billion now. And so you'd keep stuff like this around and rerun new tests with more accurate, with different instruments, different capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's at Area 51 or any one of a dozen other labs that had high security clearances and incredible capabilities. Remember, right there in New Mexico, Los Alamos is one of the finest labs in the world. I've been there. Money's no object when it comes to getting good equipment and good people. And so, you know, there's Oak Ridge, there's MIT, there's Hanford, there's a whole bunch of these places. And so, you know, the black budget each year, who knows what it is, but it's been estimated at $30 to $50 billion a year being spent on projects that we don't know anything about. So somewhere, I'm sure, there were people who were doing their best not only to determine what the materials were, but developing techniques for duplicating it. Those are two different steps. You know, it's one thing to know what an atomic bomb is mm-hmm. made out of, but it's quite different to provide this, you know, to create the stuff that you need to make it with. And so Yeah, they, you don't throw that away, and you don't throw the bodies away. Look, I said this to somebody the other day, talking about the bodies. I said, well, wouldn't they have done DNA testing? I said, no, they didn't know about DNA in 1947. Crick and Watson got a Nobel Prize for work that was after 47.
Exactly. And, you know, if the Richard Nixon, Jackie Gleason story is correct, Nixon showed Jackie an alien body in, at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. Could that have been from Roswell, and they moved it over there?
Well, sure. There are all kinds of places. People think how hard it is to hide stuff. It's quite the reverse. It's easy to hide stuff. The United States is big. There are places you can't fly over. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base has 1,000 buildings there. I've been there. I had business activities there, and I had a security clearance. But there are all kinds of places I couldn't go into. So it's easy to cover up stuff, to hide stuff, to have underground bases. Area 51 does have underground bases, but two obvious reasons: to stay out of sight of the spy satellites, and in case somebody's going to drop an atomic bomb on you, it's better to be down a couple thousand feet. You know, that's the real world, the way it was for a long time.
So it is possible. It's all there.
Yeah. Sure, but they're not giving us any guided tours.
No, they're not. What about reconstruction? Maybe?
Well, who knows? I think we've been trying to duplicate, and I have publicly stated I didn't think if we learned how these things work that we should put it out in the open where Osama bin Laden, if he's still alive, and his henchmen can get at it. Rule number one for security, and Jess can certainly vouch for this, is that you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They read the newspaper. They listen to you, George.
Well, they do.
I'm sure they do.
Indeed. Jesse, you obviously are now a believer in extraterrestrial life. Is it because of this episode?
Well, you know, mainly for because of this. But had I not even been associated with Roswell, in later years, you know, studying astronomy and cosmology, realizing the plethora of stars with planets, you know, we only discovered planets just a few years ago. For so many years, we thought that, well, they're probably out there, but we've never seen them, or at least detected them. But now we're detecting planetary systems all over the place. So even without Roswell, I would recognize the possibility of extraterrestrial life with visitations.
Of everything you now know about the Roswell case, Jesse, what shocks you? Is there something there that is shocking for you?
Oh, I don't know. I guess it's the fact that the government will not release the information, you know, divulge what they know about these craft. I think it's time. I think the government should release the information because I think we're mature enough to be able to withstand the knowledge that we are not alone and that probably we're not even in control of our own skies.
That's a good point. Good point indeed. How about you, Stanton? What shocked you about Roswell?
Roswell, to me, it's not the end-all and be-all of ufology. After all, I was lecturing for 10, 11 years before I ever heard about Roswell. There's plenty of other data that indicates the planet's being visited, that indicates we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. But the reason Roswell's become such a target for the debunkers is it's got it all. I mean, that means the government knows what's been going on, people in the government, not everybody, has known for 60 years, has wreckage, has bodies. It's the whole ball of wax. The arguments of the noisy negativists just crash and can't be retrieved. And so Roswell is important. It's important, too, for a different kind of way. It's an indication. Look, there have been over 2 million visitors to the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, which is 200 miles from Albuquerque, Amarillo, and El Paso.
Yeah, that's incredible.
If you're there, it's because you want to be there. That indicates that the world is interested. There's no question about that. And incidentally, I better clarify something. When I was looking up Jesse's website, I realized it's Marcel Jr. JR. In other words, www.marceljr.com. I was writing in Junior.
Oh, you were writing the whole Junior out.
You won't find it that way.
JR is right. Yeah. So, but you know, I'd like to add too that you know, it's not. This is not just the United States phenomena, but it's a worldwide phenomena. I'm sure
the former Soviet Union has crashed saucers.
Sure.
So I just wonder, you know, why are they not talking about this? So the KGB files probably is loaded with accounts of crashed vehicles.
Well, you know, there's another point. People talk about yo-yo conspiracy theorists. There are oftentimes when both sides each have their own reason for not speaking. The U-2 flights over the Soviet Union back in the 50s were illegal by international law. The United States wasn't going to talk about them. The Russians weren't going to talk about them. They knew about them, of
mm-hmm.
course, because they couldn't do anything about them, and they didn't want to admit that in public. So they had a common cause, even though they didn't get together and say, I won't talk if you don't talk. The same with the reconnaissance flights that got shot down in the 40s, 50s, 60s. We lost 166 military guys, crew members, of these airplanes that were tickling North Korea, China, and the Soviet Union. It wasn't until 2001 when the government called a meeting and they gave medals to the families, that the families found out what had happened to their husbands, fathers, brothers, whatever. And the Russians didn't say anything. We shot down some Russian planes. We didn't say anything. So there are often times when both sides would just as soon keep their mouth closed.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, really.
Have either one of you seen a UFO?
I haven't.
I haven't. How about you, Jesse?
Well, you know, I have well over 3,000 hours in a helicopter, and I have to say I've seen some unusual phenomena, but nothing I could really downright say, hey, that is a UFO from outer space. But, yeah, there's a lot of lights in the sky, but goodness knows. Maybe some were, but vast majority are not. So I can't really say for sure that I've seen one.
Stan, the UFO cases that we seem to be getting now seem to be individual cases. You know, Phoenix, one over O'Hare. We don't seem to get the UFO flaps that we used to get 20, 30, 40 years ago. How come?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the press coverage of the events. It's routine almost, although I'm hopeful because of the great response to that Chicago Tribune article about the O'Hare sighting. That, you know, that story got a million hits. I mean, I'm still bowled over.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
More than any other story they carried. And I think that the test of whether what I think is happening is happening will be the coverage of Roswell when Jesse and I are there. There are a lot of other speakers. I don't mean we're the only ones there, obviously. But will the press play it straight, or will they try to pick up silly season is here again kind of?
What have they done in the past?
It's been a mix. At the 50th anniversary celebration, there were over 300 press people, and it got a lot of coverage. Time magazine, which sort of deplored the whole business, they put Roswell on the cover in big print in a stupid drawing of an alien female that doesn't look like anything anybody's ever described. It was their biggest selling issue of that year, 10 years ago, until Princess Di died, which was later that same year. So they recognize the attraction of it, but they're constrained by their perception that most people think it's nonsense. When I did the Larry King show out in the desert near Area 51.
I remember that.
Years ago.
Wasn't Art sitting in one of those chairs next to you?
No.
He was not there. Because I know it was Larry King, there was you, there was like four people there, right?
Yeah, Kevin Randall was there, and Dr. Stephen Greer was there. And Glenn Campbell, not the musician, but
God, I thought Art was sitting there.
Well, he was not too far away in Pahrump. No, Art wasn't there. But
okay. I thought he was sitting in the chair.
I asked about getting telephone calls because you're out in the middle of nowhere, right across from Little Alien, you know. And they said, oh, yes, we'll get calls. They'll come into Atlanta. They'll go by satellite to the big truck that nobody will see that's way over there. And she says, we'll monitor them very carefully. Because, of course, most people don't believe in UFOs. And I said, wait a minute, where'd you get that? And proceeded to put out chapter and verse what the polls show, that most people do believe in UFOs. The greater the education, the more likely to believe in UFOs. But here's the kicker. Their perception that most people don't believe in UFOs affected their choice of little bits that they had all kinds of people saying. You know, William Shatner, great astronaut, was asked to come. And Carl Sagan and Phil Klass and others, And their percentage of believers versus non-believers was very much tilted by their false perception that most people didn't believe. And so I'm hoping that we'll do better this time. And I think that Fife Symington, the former governor of Arizona, you know, when he came out with his story that he'd seen the Phoenix Lights, that got a lot of coverage, especially since he'd been a fighter pilot. And I'm hoping that that will continue. And we have a younger generation, unlike Jesse and I, and I'm even older than Jesse.
Oh, no, can't be.
I'll hit 73 this coming month. But the younger generation has grown up with the idea of life in outer space, space travel, government lies. You know, I grew up in a simpler time, and Jesse did. We didn't think in terms of the government lie. But there are an awful lot of people now who think in terms of the government lie.
Absolutely. Yeah, that, now, the King thing that was done in 94, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's right. You know why? Because I, at that time, really didn't know Art Bell. I confused him years later with Stephen Greer when I would think about that show.
Steve was on the show. As a matter of fact, it was funny because when Larry was introducing us at the beginning, he called me doctor. And I said, no, Larry, he's the doctor. I'm the mister.
I love it.
A lot of people remember that comment. You know, I said, hey, if I let it go by, people will think I lied to Larry, and they will indict me, and so I
good
can't
point.
Let that free doctorate go by.
Pick up on any little discrepancy at all.
Yeah.
Good point at all. Stan, you're going to stay for questions with Jesse?
Yeah, I'm sure going to stay. Yep.
Man, you have energy, both of you. Okay, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to open up the phone lines now, give you an opportunity, this historical opportunity, to talk to Jesse Marcel Jr. He's the author of The Roswell Legacy. Wrote this book because he wanted all of us to know about his father, telling the story of his father and his own story, of course. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. These visitors, Stan, not just the Roswell case. In your opinion, who are they? Where are they coming from?
Well, I talk about where they come from in my new book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, because it's the only case I know that's by myself and Kathleen Martin, who's Betty Hill's niece and has all her papers and stuff. The star map work there, which is talked about in the book, and I deal with the objections from the debunkers, indicates that at least some of these guys are coming from a planet around either Zeta 1 or Zeta 2 Reticuli, and that a very different situation from our own. The next star over from the sun is only 4.3 light years away, only, I say. It's a good way. These two stars are both sun-like stars. They're only an eighth of a light year apart. That means they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boonies. And they've got next-door neighbors. And they're a cool billion years older than the sun. So it would seem to me perfectly logical that they would be the neighborhood center, if you will, out from which interstellar travelers migrated. I mean, let's face it, there's much more incentive to develop interstellar travel when you've got a neighbor. Remember, you can see the other star all day long from a planet around the other star, something we can't do, obviously. We don't see many stars during the day. And it's no big deal, an eighth of a light year. You know, you go to Congress for money. Sure, we can go there. It's not such a big deal. So I think that's where some of them come from. And the kicker here is that billion-year head start on us. Bishop Usher figured out that the Earth was created on October 23rd, I think it was, 4004 B.C. Now, our picture of the universe has changed since then. Now we're talking billions of years. So, you know, rather than thinking we're the crown of creation, I think we don't know any more about what's going on outside of this planet than the apes in the nature preserves in Africa. I don't think we're the big shot, so I think we're at the bottom of the chart, so to speak.
Stan, what was that story about Epsilon, was it Butes, that there was some kind of satellite going around our planet? Do you ever remember that?
Well, there were all kinds of things about satellites being detected before we had satellites up there, and then a kind of star map. Yeah, I remember, and I can't remember the guy's name, it's on the tip of my tongue, who published, starts with an L. That's what happens when you get old. You remember, it starts with an L.
Well, we'll find it. Someone will get it to us.
There was a supposed map that he figured out that this had to do with alien sources. And that's in my gray basket as well. But the work on Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli has stood up amazingly well. I talked to Terrence Dickinson, who'd been the editor of Astronomy Magazine when they published that big, very popular article about the star map work at my instigation. I'm an instigator way back in the 70s. And he, too...
It was John Keel, wasn't it?
What?
Wasn't it John Keel?
No. Oh, no. Not John Keel.
Because somebody... he
published
wrote
the first article in Saga magazine about...
Okay. He wrote a book called Visitors from Space, which he talked about the star system, Epsilon Butes.
Oh, yeah, Duncan Lunan, that was his name.
Lunan, okay.
Yeah, he's the guy who talked about booties, or however you pronounce that. But I can't help how you... You know, I didn't name any of the constellations. Don't blame me for it.
I'm not blaming you.
The reticulin stuff, what's happened, incidentally, and one of the major changes, not only have we discovered lots of planets, well over 200 now in the local neighborhood, but our techniques for measuring distance, once we start using space-based observing systems instead of planetary-based ones, the Hipparchos satellite put up by the European Space Agency several years ago made millions of measurements and cut down the error bars, and now we have a much better picture of where things are and how far away they are and how close they are to their neighbors and all that sort of thing. And that's what makes it amazing that Marjorie Fish's work with the Betty Hill star map has stood up so well, despite a whole new approach to how we find out about things. So... that's my best bet for where some of these guys come from. But I think, really, that there's a network of civilizations, call it the Galactic Federation, if you will. You know, it makes sense to me. We move out, we migrate, we colonize, things change. You know, I ask people sometimes when they get obstreperous, well, how many of you had your ancestors living here 50 generations ago? And occasionally I get an American Indian who can raise their hand, but most of us, our families migrated to North America, colonized North America. And yeah, I know people can say, hey, look, Australia got started by those convicts, you know. Maybe we're the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy.
I think we are. Let's go to the phones. We'll go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mr. Friedman, Mr. Marcel. Yes, I believe Mr. Friedman knows my dad, Bob.
And what would your last name be? Do you want to tell us that? Or?
Bob Shirky is my dad.
Ah.
Oh, yes, I do know him.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I just wanted to tell you that I never knew anything about that. I was born in Roswell in 1949, and like Mr. Marcel was saying, nobody ever talked about this. I didn't even know anything about it until I was watching television. Unsolved Mysteries, I think, back in 89, 86, somewhere in there.
Yeah, 89.
So the military silence was the way they all were, and my dad was that. And my dad was there, and he did see this. And I know that he got involved with Mr. Kaufman, and I've realized now Mr. Kaufman was part of the... He was a storyteller, but that...
nice way to put it. Yeah, I met your dad.
Yes, I know you did.
He was the operations officer who prepared the plane that Jesse and his wreckage went to Fort Worth on.
That's right. He was the weights man. He had to weigh it before they put the wreckage on. He stood there with Colonel Blanchard and watched them load the material on the plane. And it really happened. I don't doubt my father. He was a very straight military guy and Well, he still is, but he's very ill right now. But he won't be making it to Roswell this year either. But
oh, that's a shame. Now, John, when you say it really happened, in your opinion, what was it that your dad talked about?
Well, he and Walter Haught and Glenn Dennis and those folks, I've known those men all my life. Glenn Dennis was the funeral home director there,
right?
And he actually took care of the funerals for my grandparents and many of my relatives. And Walter Hart lived down the street from
all of you.
And
yeah.
Well, not too far from my aunt and uncle. And we all grew up together.
Small town.
And my dad just told me that it was something that he had never seen before, and he was a pilot. He had flown, and he knew the buzz on the base at that time. And
if they were balloon parts or you know, parts of wreckage of craft, your father probably would have been able to identify that, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. He saw the beams. He saw the same beams being loaded on the airplane to be flown out, and he said it was nothing that any of them had ever seen before. And the colors were different, and the writing was different, and it wasn't anything that they knew of, you know. And, of course, the story came down over after many people had come out. After the story broke, then other folks, of course, came around and started sharing what they had seen. And my dad wasn't someone, he's not somebody just to spin a tale. And I just wanted to put that out, and I want to thank Mr. Friedman and Mr. Marcel for... And you, George, of course, for continuing this, and Dart and everybody.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you for everything you're doing, and
thank
have
you.
A good time in Roswell.
Okay, so there we go again, Stan and Jesse. More backup for
well,
what you've
matter
said.
Of fact, it was Bob Shirky who drove me out to Lincoln on Billy the Kid Day to have my first conversation with Glenn Dennis back when I was in town to do the NBC Unsolved Mysteries program in 89. And I talked to Bob before that, and then I called Glenn, and he said, you know, why don't we talk about it? And Bob drove me out in his car, and we had trouble parking. The one day a year when you can't park at Lincoln is Billy the Kid Day.
I love it. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
Name's Alex. How's it going, you guys?
Good, Alex. Thank you.
George, first time
sure
anyway.
Thing.
Gentlemen, I just have a quick question. I've been to Roswell, New Mexico, went to the UFO Museum. Awesome. Absolutely awesome. I believe that that happened. I believe in the Travis Walton case back in 1975. And my question to you guys is, do you think Bob Lazar's claim is true that he actually worked in Area 51 and we have 9 UFOs in a thing that he de-engineered back in the late 80s?
If you go to my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, you'll see my take on Bob Lazar. I did a lot of checking, called lots of people at MIT and Caltech and Pierce Junior College, which is the one school he did attend. He didn't attend the others. What I found is Bob is an imaginative, bright guy who's made up a fancy story, and it doesn't stand up to careful analysis. I talked to his high school. He was in the bottom third of his high school class, incidentally, which proves he didn't go to MIT. So he's a bright guy. He puts on fireworks displays, or has in the past. Drove a jet-powered car, which is kind of nifty, frankly.
Los Alamos.
Yeah, but he didn't work for Los Alamos. He worked for a subcontractor, a company that hired people to work with professors who came into the big accelerator there. And he was a technical assistant, if you will, at Los Alamos. But the phone book shows he definitely worked for Kirk Meyer Corporation, not for the lab. So he tells a great story, sells a lot of videos, but his physics is faulty, and his story about his own background is faulty. So,
okay. I was just very curious.
Yeah, well, take a look at the article, www.stantonfriedman.com. My Take on Bob Lazar, I think it's called. You'll find it.
What about Dan?
Words.
Well, how about Dan Burrish, Dan?
My personal opinion is that that's baloney, too. But that's a personal opinion. I've talked to Dan's mother, believe it or not.
Dodie. I have, too, yeah.
But I've talked to George Knapp, and I'm impressed with George. And George
yep.
and I disagree about Bob Lazar, but... George did a lot of checking on Burrish, and the story doesn't seem to hold up. So I haven't written an article about it, though.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Wild card line, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hello, George.
Yeah, hi.
This is Jonathan calling out of Barksdale Air Force Base.
Okay, you're in Louisiana, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
I remember. Go ahead.
Got a quick question for you guys. I'll listen to the answer over there.
Okay.
What would be the use of a UFO having lights on it?
Having what?
Lights on it, Stan. Good question. It's a good question. Why would a UFO have lights all over it?
Well, you can think of several reasons. One, so that other UFOs would know where it is when they're getting together for lunch, so that they avoid collisions with conventional airplanes. Pilots are always looking, just can certify this, they're always looking for lights which stand out in the air more than objects. It's just like headlights on the ground. Comes nighttime, you want the other guy to have headlights on. And it may be a means for signaling. Who knows?
What if its propulsion system generates the glow, Stan?
I think the glow might indeed be connected to a propulsion system. You ionize the air, interact with electric and magnetic fields, magneto-aerodynamics, which sounds pretty exotic. But when I did a literature search on this decades ago, I got over 900 references. 90% of them were classified. This is a technical report search. You can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, and incidentally, that glow stuff, we are interested because when nose cones come into the atmosphere, you know, with a little A-bomb or H-bomb on board, they ionize the air, and you want to be able to detect and tell the difference between the dummies and the real ones. And so you want to find out all about that, and I think it may be the key to their propulsion system, similar, and you'll get a kick out of this, to the electromagnetic submarine that was successfully operated way back in the 60s by Dr. Stuart Way of Westinghouse at University of California, Santa Barbara. Talked about that in my congressional testimony in 1968. It makes me feel old to say that.
It really does. Hey, Jesse, of everything your dad showed all of you, did he hold back anything in terms of, did he throw a little I-beam in a drawer or anything like that?
No. You know, this is all Air Force property, so I didn't keep any of it, and neither did any of us. No, this was not ours to keep.
That would be historical, Stan, if we had that, huh?
Well, yeah, I keep looking. I think there's some pieces out there, probably. Yeah, Pappy Henderson had some. We don't know where that wound up. He was a pilot on the base who flew some wreckage and only spoke about it after an article appeared in the newspaper in 1980. That's typical of military guys. He thought it was classified, but here's an article in the paper, so now he told his wife about it, and I talked to her and their daughter and his son-in-law, and no question, he had a piece. GIs, during World War II especially, had a tendency to bring back souvenirs. You know, all those Lugers and knives and all kinds of things. So I don't doubt that there are some pieces of wreckage someplace out there. And if anybody's got one, I know where to get it tested. Go to my website and call me.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with Stan and Jesse. Go ahead.
Hello, Jesse. Hello, Stan and George.
Hi.
Yeah.
An honor and a pleasure to be able to speak to you, Jesse. I'd like to also thank you for your service to our country all these many years.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And I've been wanting to ask you this question for more than 10 years now. Well, actually, a question and a comment. Were you satisfied with your portrayal in the film version of yourself that came out 10 years ago, or I think 94?
Well, you know, there's a lot of poetic license with it. You know, they depicted me keeping some of it back in a cigar box. Certainly that didn't happen. And I guess they portrayed the material as being on the kitchen table. It was on the floor. I mean, there are minor discrepancies.
Also, have you ever considered, for the sake of humanity, going under hypnosis to get a full and accurate picture of the events that took place your father brought those items home?
Yeah, they've tried hypnosis on me, but I guess I'm not a very good subject for hypnosis. I guess I'm not a real strong believer in being able to retrieve things that you can't retrieve consciously. Maybe it's true, but I just think I'm not a very good subject for hypnosis, but they have tried.
I also have a comment for Stanton about the Betty and Barney Hill story. But also, Jesse, if you could answer also, do you plan on making or producing or being part of a production of your biography and your father's biography in the future?
Yeah, I don't know of any plans for that at this time.
Okay, for Stanton, I've spoken to you before. the James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons piece, the movie that they did for television about Betty and Barney Hill?
Yes.
That movie, there's some kind of controversy going on because it's not available anywhere. And the only existing copies were in Europe, in Germany, on VHS, and they were pulled from the market there. Now there are bootleg, really poor versions of it are available occasionally on eBay, but you cannot find it anywhere. It's as if there's a disinformation campaign not allowing people to view it. If you could find out about that with the niece, that with Betty's niece, why that's going on.
Well, I'll ask Kathleen about it. I was a technical advisor on that to Universal Studios, and I thought they did a great job, incidentally, as such things went. And Betty and I touted it on the Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder just before it was on, you know, saying what was going to be on. I'm a little surprised at that, but do remember that that was before people had VCRs in general.
Mm-hmm.
I probably have a copy of it someplace around here, but... Yeah, you're right. It hasn't been pushed anywhere that I have seen. And, you know, James Earl Jones had bought the rights, the movie rights, to the story.
Really? I didn't know that. Hey, Stan, stay with us. You as well, Jesse. Final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jesse, you've got the word out in a fine way about your father's story and your own. How does that make you feel? When you see this book in print now, how do you feel about it?
Well, I feel satisfied. I feel justified. And I'm just glad it's been done. There's a lot of work to do this, but again, I just feel very satisfied with it.
Good for you, and you should, and you should. And Stan, how about you? What fuels you, Stan? Here you go again. I met you in 1971. It's amazing. Here we are still kicking, but heck, you were 85 years old then. So,
well, I'll tell you, George, what fuels me, if you will, is the enthusiastic response of my audiences, of the professional groups that I've talked to, and lots of them, college audiences, and the fact that so many people come up to me afterward. Well, when I was on your show years ago, I offered some free information, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to my post office box 958 in the beautiful downtown Holton, Maine, 047-0958. I got 1,000 requests, George, all but 5 with the envelope, and over 200 post-it notes saying, keep up the good work. I've been following you for 20 years or 30 years, as the case may be. These are people I don't know. They don't know me, but there's a constituency out there. There are people who are very pleased to have somebody stand up and tell it like it is. You know, I don't need to worry about my boss giving me a hard time. My boss is me. So I take advantage of that situation. I know people who would like to speak out. And can say things just as clever as I say, but who are afraid to because of their circumstances. So it's the feedback I get. I'm not a masochist. People say, you must get a hard time. I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and I come on pretty darn strong.
Probably the same guy.
What?
Probably the same heckler, whoever he was. Huh?
Well, it could be. The government sends him around to give me a hard time.
Exactly.
What I'm saying is, I have the satisfaction of knowing that a lot of people feel they've learned something, taken a new view. That's why I have an article on my website called The UFO Why Questions, because people are ready to accept the facts and data that I present, the 5 large-scale scientific stuff. But what they really want to know is, so how come this, that, and the other thing? And the normal response, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, I've been forced to think. I think I've answered 45,000 questions over the years, same questions over and over again, you understand. But so people seem to be impressed by the fact that I've given them something to think about, not just surface stuff. And so there's a great deal of satisfaction with that. I think of myself as kind of a teacher, if you will. Also, the mental health function. People are so anxious to tell somebody, but they're afraid to because of the fear of ridicule. That's one of the things that keeps me going, is taking on the noisy, nasty, negativeness, because people need somebody to stand up for them and say, this isn't nutty stuff. There's some nuts out there. Of course there are. What's that got to do with anything? You know, I'm like the gold miner. I'm looking for the good stuff. There's an ounce of gold per ton of ore. That's worth mining. So... Could there be a bigger subject than a new view of our place in the universe, alien visitations, and government cover-up, the cosmic Watergate? I don't think so. So I'm still energized by the people out there.
Good for you. Let's go to final calls. West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George. How you doing tonight?
Good.
Great show. I was wondering, I wanted to ask a question about the piece of metal that his father showed to him with all the symbols on it. I thought they had proven that it came, those symbols came from a toy company that created an adhesive paint. Do you know what I'm sure you've heard this question a million times.
Oh, yeah. Tell him, Jesse. The toy, tape from the toy company to hold together the Mogul balloons, which don't explain anything.
Yeah. Well, the toy company was the only company that made that industrial tape. So they say. I'm just trying to find out the truth.
Okay.
I know that's what the show's all about.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, is there any truth to that? Or
they used tape. It was actually about a 1-inch wide cellophane tape with flowers imprinted on the tape itself. And this was used to affix the aluminum foil to balsa wood sticks, kite sticks. And the symbols were not flowers, and certainly they were not on tape. And actually, they were much smaller than the symbols or the flowers would have been on the Scotch tape. So we're talking about different dimensions and different patterns, and it just wasn't the same thing.
Yeah, okay. That's, you know what? I'm glad you told me that. But I have one more question. I know the military, they put out two reports. Everybody knows the first one was bogus about a balloon, and the second one they put out that it was a top secret
mogul,
something to do with the going under the radar in Russia.
No, the Mogul balloon was designed to be a constant altitude balloon to detect the sounds of a Soviet nuclear explosion.
Okay.
That was in the first report, about 1,000 pages. The Roswell report, Fact versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. Unfortunately, the Air Force supplied the fiction. The second report was the Roswell report, Case Closed, and that had the unique explanation of crash test dummies that weren't dropped until six years after Roswell.
Okay.
And that were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds, which suddenly somehow got morphed by time and space to become little guys seen near Roswell.
It's been like 10 years since I heard the report, and the whole time I was thinking it was bogus, so it kind of slipped out of my mind, but I was just hoping you could remind me, because, you know, I'd really like to know the truth.
You won't find it in the Air Force reports.
I know.
Sure. Look
I
at
don't
Jesse's
trust it.
Book.
I wouldn't trust anything the military or the government told me about UFOs.
Well, yeah,
it's a good idea not to. Start off with the idea they're not telling the truth, and that gets you somewhere when it comes to the government and UFOs.
Stan, do you think we're afraid to handle the truth as individuals?
I don't think so. Look, I've had all those audiences, some as big as 2,000, and I don't see anybody going outside fearful and looking around and waiting to be attacked by aliens or anything like that. I think, sure, the story has to be played right. And, you know, we're not talking about War of the Worlds. That's not how you present it. I was in New Jersey in 1938. I didn't hear about it then. But New Jerseyites had a right to panic if they believed the story, because what can we do about Martians? I mean, they're attacking us. They're destroying us. But if you present it in an entirely different fashion, the Earth is being visited. We've had reasons for covering things up because we wanted to find out more about what they're doing, how they operate, all the rest of that. But we are calling international conferences of, let's say, religious leaders, economics leaders, political leaders, to see what the impact of this will be on our planet. I think the public can handle it. Will there be a small percentage of people who react badly? Of course. Maybe mental hospital admissions will go up. You know, that wouldn't surprise me. The stock market will go down because uncertainty is always the enemy. But I think that the public can handle it. Times have changed. Nobody talked about space travel back then. You were laughed about in 47. You know, that's Buck Rogers and that's Flash Gordon. And none of the, if you look at the press coverage, they weren't talking about alien spacecraft. It was some unknown playing them. It may be our government, maybe Russians, who knew what. And maybe from outer space, but certainly that wasn't the general tenure. They weren't talking about bodies. Entirely different perception then, and the world has changed. And incidentally, people thought that the process that produced the planets, like ours, were so rare that they never happened anyplace else.
Not anymore.
Close to each other. Now we're finding them a dime a dozen out there, you know. So the whole perception of things has changed.
Like I told Seth Shostak 10 years ago, the guy you debated and so brilliantly won, but a good man nonetheless, isn't he?
Yes,
but
I liked it.
I told Seth 10 years ago, and here's a guy without any astronomical background, me. I said, Seth, the whole universe is the same. Everything's the same. The elements are the same. You know, everything is made the same. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And you know what, Stan? I'm right.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, anybody who thinks we're all there is has got another thought coming.
Well, there's nothing unique about us.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Danny from Denver.
Hey, Danny.
Two quick questions. Were the cockpit recordings Freddie Valentich made, were those ever released publicly, or was that just for his family? And in terms of credibility, why wasn't George Marshall included in the Majestic 12 documents?
Well, I missed the first question. George Marshall was undoubtedly, Truman thought he was the most important or most significant American. But he was a lot older than those guys. He probably was asked for advice as to which military guy should be on it, what the division should be. The Marshall plan was just coming into effect, as a matter of fact, in the summer of 47. But George was almost a generation older than these other guys, and he was not in great health. He did serve his country as much as he could. He was Secretary of State and then Secretary of Defense briefly. But he would have been the elder statesman, not the active guy with day-to-day responsibilities. Basically, he had retired. He was a great American. I've been to the Marshall Archives. It's a great place to do research, but not an appropriate age or background to be part of such a group at that time.
He had retired, but he was called out of retirement during the Korean War.
Well, to be Secretary of Defense briefly, yes, but he wasn't in good health. As a matter of fact, there are comments about his health if you go to his library and to the Truman Library.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he would have had a big say in who would have been on there. Truman trusted his opinion. George Marshall was one of the great patriots. I have the greatest respect for the man. But if you look in my book, Top Secret Magic, when I talk about the MJ-12 guys, I have a list that shows the dates of birth and the age at the time and all the rest of that. And those guys were all considerably younger than George was.
He was the greatest general in American history.
Well, he certainly ran the war effort, World War II, almost single-handedly at the top of the heap. They didn't have platoons of second, third, fourth level people then. They had guys who could make decisions and did make them. And I've talked to the Marshall Archives, people who are experts on George, and you can just tell the great respect they had for him.
Absolutely.
He earned that respect.
And the cockpit recordings, which one were you talking about? Was that the Holland one of 97?
Freddie Valentich.
The place near Tasmania and Australia.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Richard Haynes.
To his family, but I don't know if they were ever released publicly.
He has a whole book about the Valentich case. And I don't know whether they were made public. I actually met Valentich's father when I was touring in Australia, and I was favorably impressed. But I would go to Dick Haynes, Dr. Richard Haynes, go to the Internet, and you'll find the book about Valentich. And he talks about the cockpit recordings, but if you're asking whether they're public, that's a question I can't answer.
Is he the one who disappeared? He merely just disappeared? Something was coming at him?
Not only him, but his plane
also. Yeah, everything got gobbled up.
And they were taping the conversation as was normal, and it's clear something was near him, and he was bothered by it, and there was a strange sound, and gone. And they did a search, of course. Never found him.
You never wonder what it was. I mean, could a large bird have smashed into him or something?
No, this thing was there for quite some period of time. He was reporting. That's why the cockpit recordings are important. It wasn't the cockpit recordings. It was the radar installation that was recording their conversation with him. They never found the plane.
Did radar pick up whatever the other object might have been?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't think they did.
Let us go east of the Rockies. You're up with Jesse Marcel and Stanton Friedman. Hi.
Hello, Jesse, and hello Dr. Stanton Friedman.
Mister, he's the doctor, not me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Shades of Larry King.
Sorry about that. I go to a lot of conventions, and frequently I do different conventions, the crash retrieval in Vegas and outside. There was a convention Jesse attended in Mesa, Arizona. This had to be about 93, 94.
Mm-hmm.
I was in attendance to that convention. At the time, someone asked you a question about the meeting between John F. Kennedy and Jesse Marcel, and you did not explain why you did not want to talk about the meeting at the time at the convention. It's been bothering me for the last 14 years. I was curious what happened.
Save him, Jesse.
Well, there was never any meeting between me and President Kennedy.
But not yourself. I'm talking about maybe your dad, because someone asked you a question, and you said, I'm not allowed to discuss that at this time.
Well, no, I don't think that's the meeting that they were referring to. My dad had a lot of meetings, and, of course, I'm not privy to all of them that he went to about this, so who knows?
Maybe he's referring to a meeting that you and I each had separately with an individual.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe that's
in the Washington area. I've been trying to get a hold of him, and I've left messages, but no luck so far.
Not to stir up any conspiracy here, but you're really, you know, avoiding the answer to any question. I was just curious. I was sitting back there waiting, and it was about 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, you pretty much took off in a rush.
Well, you know, I just didn't feel comfortable in discussing that meeting.
Okay. And also, George, one last question. I know we're wrapping up over here. I know you're from Michigan also, and I had some incidents that took place outside the Holland area back in 94, 96. I don't know if you're familiar with the Holland, Michigan.
Oh, sure. You mean the tulip area.
Tulip time.
You got it.
There was an incident that took place in 86. And regarding on that, it was the same incident that took place in 94, 96.
Really? Okay. I'm not familiar with the episode because I was in St. Louis at that time. What happened?
It was the local police found some UFOs flying over. They were chasing them on the weather screen, and police were signal out to follow on these blue, yellow, and white lights outside Holland, Michigan. It was seen in Holland, Ohio, around the tri-state area.
Okay, thank you for that. Jesse, at what point, if ever, did things kind of calm down in Roswell when you were the little 11-year-old? I mean, did it go away relatively soon, or did it still fester?
As soon as the Air Force emptied the story, that was it. That was the end of the story. No more discussion.
Do you remember media flocking down there at the time? Of course, we really didn't have television news at 47.
No.
We had radio coverage and newspapers. Was it a barrage of press people?
Well, you know, I really was not privy to that, or at least part of that. I do know that my dad, they accused him of being publicity Marcel because he was getting calls all over the world, including people in China were calling him about this thing. But as far as locally, I think that story died really fast.
There was a radio broadcast about this, Stanton, wasn't there at the time?
Yeah, out of Chicago, I think, though. Yeah, radio certainly, essentially no television. And
no television.
The evening papers from Chicago West carried the story on July 8th, which leaves out the New York Times and the Washington Post. The East Coast papers did not. It was too late when the story went out from Walter Howe. The next day's papers, the 9th, are the ones Ramey empties Roswell's saucer. They only had the cover-up story, but there is one paper, the Los Angeles Herald Express, that had a big headline, Army Captures Flying Saucers, General Thinks It's Radar Weather Gadget. The cover-up was already in place on July 8th.
Well, the name of the book, The Roswell Legacy, their websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Stan and Jesse, I'll see you in Roswell in a couple weeks, all right?
Indeed.
Look forward to it.
That'll be fun. See you guys in the flesh. For Wayne Roberts, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Gibbous, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Lisa Lyon, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.